So we thought that for this sequence, we would come down to Earth or come down to ourselves, to the mind, which is what Buddhism is concerned with, how our minds work with our experience, and particularly look at positive mental states, the nice ones, the helpful ones, the constructive ones, the creative ones even. And while I was thinking about it, I came across this quote from Shantideva, where he's talking to himself, and he's saying, mind, mind, be strong, because he realizes in order to cultivate creative states of mind, it takes quite a lot of discipline, quite a lot of determination. And he's saying it's really worth it, it's really worth being strong, being determined. So that's why I thought we'd use that as a sort of a slogan for the series. But they won't all be on Shantideva. But because that slogan comes from Shantideva, I thought, why not look at Shantideva's own approach? He's one of the great Buddhist teachers, one of the great Indian Buddhist teachers. I'm just circulating some pictures of him so you can have a look, see what he's like. And he lived in India in the 700s, so quite a long time ago, when the Vikings were just starting to get interested in this country. And he apparently was an aristocrat. His father was the ruler of a small state in what is now Gujarat. It's called Saurashtra, the state of Saurashtra. And he became a Buddhist as a young, well, as a teenager actually, and was taught the meditation on Manjushri. And Manjushri was always very important to him. Now, this tanka here, which is from Nepal, is an image of Manjushri. So Manjushri is a bodhisattva, in other words, in this case, a mythical or archetypal figure who represents wisdom. The colour of his skin is the same colour as a lion's eye or a sun shining through amber. And he wields a flaming sword, and it's not a sword for hurting people, it's a sword for cutting through conceptions. Cutting through conceptions. And he holds a book of wisdom, sometimes on a lotus by his shoulder, or sometimes pressed to his heart. So this was the meditation, the visualization that Shantideva was taught when he was quite young. And in particular, he was taught to say the mantra over and over again, Om Mara Pajananti, Om Mara Pajananti. Now, he was 19 when his father died, and so he was expected to take over running the state. And his mother prepared a bath for him on the day before. This is what, it's, I don't know how true these stories are, they're very old. Anyway, it says his mother prepared a bath for him on the day before the coronation. And he got in the bath, and it was absolutely scalding hot. And his mother looked at him and said, if you become the king, it's going to be like that every day. You will be in hot water. Anyway, he went to bed, and he had a dream. And in the dream, he saw Manjushri sitting on the throne. And he came up to the throne, and Manjushri said, you can't sit here. I'm sitting here. And so when he woke up in the morning, he decided that these two events implied that he needed to make a change of plan. And so he scarpered. He ran away. Didn't even tell everybody. He just ran away. And for some time, he fled into the dark forest, and he wandered in the forest apparently for 21 days, for 3 weeks. He was thirsty, he was hungry, and then he met a woman. And this woman was, so we're told, Tara in disguise. Now Tara, who again you may be familiar with, I put her statue here. She's a female Buddha or Bodhisattva form, and she represents active compassion. And she was also always very important in his imaginative life. And so she came and she had some water, and she led him through the forest, and there he met a mysterious teacher. And later he decided that this teacher must have been Manjushri in disguise. So after receiving these teachings, living in the forest, learning to meditate, he decided to set out for Nalanda. And Nalanda was a great monastic university, possibly the greatest the world has ever seen in the sense of its size. At one stage, apparently, it had 50,000 students, all living in one complex. And it was, in a way, the center of Buddhist learning. Over on the other side of India, Gujarat, as you probably know, is on the left-hand side of India. I think that means the west, doesn't it? While Nalanda was much over towards the area where the Buddha himself had been active 1,000 years earlier. And so he had to walk all the way across India, but he decided to go there to Nalanda. He went to Nalanda and said, please, can I become a monk? Can I become a pupil, a student here, in other words? And so he was let in. But after his ordination as a monk, he got a bit of a reputation at Nalanda University, and it wasn't a very good reputation. And in fact, the reputation was such that he was given a nickname, and this nickname was Busuku. Busuku. Bu means eat. Su means sleep. Ku means shit. So the reputation he had was that all he ever did, he would turn up. You know, monks have to eat before 12. He'd turn up at 11:30. He would have 5 bowls of rice. Then he would go off back to his cell, and nothing would be heard from there apart from snoring. People would look in there, they'd see him fast asleep. The only other time they ever saw him was in the toilets. So they decided to call him Eat Shit Sleep. These were known as his 3 perfections. Now, little did they know, of course, that the abbot of the university had set him up to studying and meditating all night when everybody else was asleep, saying again the mantra of Manjushri over and over again, Om Narapajanadi. Anyway, nobody else knew about this. And the other scholars, they didn't want to have a lazy monk around, and they tried to get the abbot to expel him, and the abbot said, well, he hasn't done anything wrong. I mean, there's nothing in the rules that says you're not allowed to eat. There's nothing in the rules that says you're not allowed to sleep. There's nothing in the rules that says you're not allowed to shit. So what's the problem? And so they decided, no, we've got to find another way of doing it. I know what we'll do. So they put his name up on the notice board in the monastery to give the monthly Dharma talk. They said, he's just going to run away. He knows nothing. He's done no study at all. This will sort him out. So they put his name up there, and he tried to sort of get out of it, wriggle out of it, and they wouldn't let him. So he had to go and give the Dharma talk. And to increase his humiliation, they made the Dharma seat from which you give the talk like about this high, with no ladder going up to it. Anyway, so he turned up in the courtyard of the monastery to give the talk. All 500 of the university's greatest scholars were there to see Busuku's humiliation. But apparently he just put his hand on the top of this seat, and somehow he was there. I don't know if he was good at vaulting or something, but somehow there he was. You know, so that was the first little remarkable thing that happened. And he said to them, when he got to the top, he said, okay, would you like an old teaching where I just recite some sutras, or would you like a new one? And they said to him, well, you've discovered wonderful new ways of eating, sleeping, and shitting, so I think we would like to have a new one from you. And out came the Bodhicharya Avatara. Out came this amazing poem. It's a philosophical poem. It's actually been translated into English many times because it's so popular. This was one of the earlier translations called Entering the Path of Enlightenment, Marian Matix. The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. That's by Stephen Batchelor's translation. Another little translation by someone associated with this order. And basically what it's about, this book, is about how to live a Buddhist life. And it's all in poetic form. It's in verses. And some of the verses are very, very beautiful. And I thought I'd talk to some extent about this. And from this extensive explanation of the whole path to enlightenment, the guide to how to live as a bodhisattva, that's what Bodhicharya Avatara, the name of the book, means, the guide to how to live as a bodhisattva. And as you probably know, a bodhisattva in this context doesn't mean one of the mythical figures. It means a person who's striving their hardest towards awakening, but with an altruistic motivation for the sake not just of themselves, but for the sake of everybody. And in fact, you can't successfully strive towards awakening just for the sake of yourself anyway. It has to be something that includes others. It's from this poem that come the verses of our Sevenfold Puja. And in fact, it was used traditionally because the poetry is so beautiful and it's so full of imagery and it's so full of very powerful exhortations. It's very often used for recitation and chanting all over the Buddhist world, all over the Mahayana Buddhist world at least, especially in Tibet. And so the sevenfold puja that we use comes from it. I'll say more about that later. And go back to the story of Shantideva. So when he came to chapter 9, it's in 10 chapters, when he came to chapter 9, which is the chapter on wisdom, and in fact, Kalpana has now got the picture that shows what happened. What can you notice about Shantideva in that picture? He's up in the air. So apparently he gently floated up off, this is what we said, he gently floated up off the chair. And when he vanished through above the courtyard, and until nobody could see him. They could still hear his voice, but they couldn't actually see him, so it said. And then when he'd finished, they were all flabbergasted because it was such an amazing piece of teaching. But they couldn't find him. He vanished. He was nowhere to be found. Now, some of the scholars were just flabbergasted by this amazing teaching, but some of them had the presence of mind to take notes. So they compared their notes as to what he'd said, and they realised they didn't all quite agree on exactly what he'd said. So they thought, this is a great teaching, we must find him to check it out, to make sure we've got it right. So they sent out a search party, and they looked all over India to find Shantideva, and eventually, it took several years, eventually they tracked him down, living as a wanderer, inhabiting the courtyard of a stupa, right down in the south of India. So he'd gone from Gujarat in the, from your point of view, in the left-hand side, to Narmada on the right-hand side, and then right down to the south, tracing out an equilateral triangle. So he had a look at their notes and corrected their notes and got it right. And he also said, by the way, if you look in the ceiling of my cell at Narmada, you'll find two other books I wrote, just in case you're interested. Mm-hmm. And so these are the three books from Shantideva, one of which unfortunately hasn't survived, but two of them have. There are other stories about him. After he left Nalanda, it said he became a wanderer, and then after he'd been a wanderer for a while, he got bored with that and decided to become a royal guard. I don't know why he wanted to pursue this profession. So he became a royal guard with a sword, a band of swordsmen, but after a while they noticed that his sword was made of wood. And they said, what use is a wooden sword? And they took him to the king, who was supposed to be guarding, and said, look, this guard is no use, he's got a wooden sword. And so the king said, according to the story, could I have a look at your sword? And Shantideva said, look, I warn you, you'll regret it. And he said, look, I insist, I must look at your sword. And so Shantideva said, in that case, please tie a scarf around your eyes. And everyone else has to close their eyes. And so he took the sword out of its scabbard, and apparently it was unbearably brilliant light coming off this sword. And this obviously refers to the flaming sword of wisdom of Manjushri. And then, again, I'll just tell you these stories. I don't know what they mean, really, but you come to your own conclusions. It said that then everybody was blinded by the light. It was so bright, even with their eyes closed. And so he went around taking tears from his eyes and placing a teardrop in each of the eyes of his fellow guardsmen and king, and that restored their sight. Then he left the king's service, went up into the mountains, and when he was up in the mountains, a rumour went round that he was killing animals, which is not a thing you're supposed to do, of course, if you're a Buddhist. And so people were very scandalised by this, and a deputation was sent out by the king to check it out, but they found that he created a new mountain ecosystem, and all the animals were breeding and were doing really well. And he was sort of looking after the area a bit like a national park. And that is the last anybody ever heard of Shantideva. Anyway, so what did he teach in his great book, The Bodhicharya Avatara, The Guide to How to Live as a Bodhisattva? So a lot of it is actually addressed to himself. Like that phrase, mind be strong. Exhorting him to practice more earnestly, convincing the reluctant parts of himself how vital it is to try to cultivate creative or more expansive states of mind. And in fact, one of his main aims is to say, look, this is really important. We waste so much time in our lives. Who knows how long we have to live? You know, what are we using our time for? And he's saying this to himself, what am I using my time for? Why am I wasting so much time? And maybe he was genuinely, you know, obsessed with eating, sleeping, and going to the toilet. I don't know. And maybe, you know, in a way he just realized, why am I wasting this time? I must do something about this. So he keeps telling him, he keeps arguing with himself, really. And look, he's obviously an intellectual. So his approach is very much to do with convincing himself how vital it is that he does his meditation, that he improves his response to other people, that he treats people better, that he doesn't just think of himself, and he doesn't just get involved with his ego all the time, all that sort of stuff. He goes through that over and over again. But he also intersperses it with these wonderful flights of imagination and devotion and gratitude to all the teachers he's had and all this kind of thing as well. So although he's arguing with himself, there's also a lot in the book that appeals to the poetic, the imaginative side as well. And it's in chapter 6 where to harden himself against these difficulties of real deep practice, that's where he says, mind be strong. And there are particular mental states that he suggested you should cultivate. There are many of these in Buddhism, we'll be looking at a lot of them in the series. But in this talk, I thought I'd just concentrate on his own recommendations as a preliminary to this series. And as I say, our main contact with Shantideva here at this centre and other Triratna centres is because his great work has been used as this source of verses for devotional chanting. Because of that combination of poetic beauty and this intense enthusiasm for practice. So I'm just going to have a little look at how it works in the selection of verses that we've used in puja. That's in a way my talk is in two halves. The first half is now finished. That was about Shantideva himself, just so that you can get a bit of context for this. The second half, I want to look at some of the mental states that he was recommending. But maybe I'll just open it up for questions at this stage before I go into that rather different type of presentation.
Did he reach enlightenment?
He's regarded as having reached enlightenment, yeah. That's, I mean, of course, who can tell? But, you know, he's now very, very highly revered throughout the Mahayana Buddhist world as a great enlightened teacher, largely on the strength of the writings that survived from him and their incredible profundity. I didn't say that chapter 10, the one where he rose through the roof, the reason he rose through the roof, in a sense, is because it is so profound. I mean, I can't make head or tail of it. I don't know what it's about. but it presents the Majjhimika view of conditioned co-production, conditionality, conditioned arising, and emptiness, and how they relate to each other.
He's not in other traditions of Buddhism. He's not used.
He's a Mahayana figure in the Bodhisattva ideal, but of course that means that most of the Buddhist world would know of him. He's more popular in Tibet than in China, but he's known, his works are known in China as well. They're translated into Chinese, they're known in Japanese, I believe. And they were known in Buddhist India. So he lived in the 700s, and Buddhism was at its height in India in those days. And it wasn't until about the year 1200, during the Muslim invasions, when Nalanda, unfortunately, was destroyed, and the monks were slaughtered, and the libraries were burnt. But that's another 400 or 500 years after his time. So there was a lot of flourishing in Nalanda and in Buddhist India right up until that time, around the year 1200.
I like that when he put his tears to his inhalant's eye.
Yes, that's beautiful.
Compassion, yeah.
Yes, that's so right. Much. And it's interesting that Tara herself is said to have emerged from a lake of tears. And there is that sense that, you know, tears, there's a quote by Dickens somewhere that says that that tears, somehow they lay the dust on our dry hearts, some quote like that. And I think sometimes we can be ashamed of crying, but I think sometimes that crying sort of represents a sympathetic connection with people, doesn't it? And I'm sure that's what it means in that case. Okay. So, let's have a look how this starts. I apologise to those of you who are very familiar with the puja, but I think sometimes it is quite good to look back at it again and maybe just to remember it in that context of that guy sitting there in the university talking to male monks, I should say. And if you read through the rest of the Bodhicharya, it does have some quite sexist stuff in it later on. I just warn you that in case you do read it. But most of it is very, very good. So it starts off like this. With Mandarava, blue lotus and jasmine, with all flowers pleasing and fragrant, and with garlands skillfully woven, I pay honour to the princes of the sages, so worthy of veneration. I envelop them in clouds of incense, sweet and penetrating, and make them offerings of food, hard and soft, and pleasing kinds of liquids to drink. I offer them lamps encrusted with jewels, festooned with golden lotus. On the paving, sprinkled with perfume, I scatter handfuls of beautiful flowers. As many atoms as there are in the 1,000,000,000 worlds, so many times I make reverent salutation to all the Buddhas of the three eras, to the Saddharma, and to the excellent community. I pay homage to all the shrines and places in which the Bodhisattvas have been. I make profound obeisance to the teachers and those to whom respectful salutation is due. So that's the way it starts, in this very sort of flowery way, with all these offerings being conjured up, offerings being made to the Buddhas, to the symbols of enlightenment, to the teachers and so on. And this is about the particular mental state that this is trying to evoke, is known as Shraddha. And I saw an interesting translation of Shraddha which is esteem, the state of esteem. And I think this is something which is a bit unfashionable nowadays, but it's a wonderful thing to have, the sense of esteem, the sense of maybe knowing people personally whom you esteem, who you feel, yeah, I'm really glad I know that person. There's someone I can go to maybe for advice, or there's someone who is worth listening to, or there's someone who has a lovely presence. And, you know, it doesn't mean that they're perfect, that they're enlightened, but there are people that one can listen to. And also one's esteem may go for your favourite authors, your favourite artists. It may go for the great spiritual teachers, including the teachers of the Buddhist tradition. It may be there, from a Buddhist point of view, for the Buddha, the Dharma, the path, and the Sangha, the community. So this is the emotion of esteem, or confidence, trust, it's sometimes called, or even faith. And you can see from that poetry that it's an attempt to awaken the imagination in the light of these objects of devotion, by imagining making, giving them bunches of flowers, lighting incense for them, cooking them a meal, all this sort of stuff. And these objects of devotion are the teachers, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, whom one hugely admires, or anyone one wants to revere. And it's also, the beginning of the Bodhicharyavatara, including those verses there, is about getting an aspiration going, having a really strong feeling that what the people you admire represent is something that you would like, not just to sort of admire from afar, but you'd like to emulate it. You'd try to make it alive in your own life. And it's quite an important distinction. I think sometimes we can, you know, we may have wonderful admiration for Nelson Mandela or something, but we wouldn't actually think of living like Nelson Mandela. I mean, I suppose you can't really. But in a way, emulating our heroes and heroines in ways that mean that we feel that our own lives can more and more express really real value, really making a difference in the world. So there's a strong sense of aspiration in the first verses of this. And this aspiration then spills out into the next bit, which is the going for refuge section. And this is what he says here. This very day I go for my refuge to the powerful protector of Bodhisattvas, whose purpose is to guard the universe, the mighty conquerors who overcome suffering everywhere. So the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are regarded as the conquerors of suffering, the jinnas of suffering. Wholeheartedly also I take my refuge in the Dharma they have ascertained, which is the abode of security against the rounds of rebirth. Likewise in the host of Bodhisattvas, which means the Sangha, I take my refuge. So this section is quite a short one, but it's quite important, I think, because it's translating that devotion, that aspiration, that esteem in the first part to a decision to have something like this at the centre of one's own life. So you say, yes, I go for refuge, which is the traditional Buddhist way of saying, I'm going to make this the most important thing in my life. Everything else can start to revolve around it, can be related in relation to it. And what this means also is deciding to deliberately work on yourself, to deliberately make an effort with the sense of yourself as an agent. So you need to feel, I can make a decision. Go for refuge is a decision that one makes. And traditionally it's said to be, go for refuge is what makes you a Buddhist. Reciting the refuge and precepts is something that all Buddhists in all schools do. So you've got to be able to take responsibility for yourself to be able to do that. And maybe in a way, if one is very scattered, if one has many, many priorities, one probably isn't ready to do that. But there comes a point where that going for refuge can become a real decision. You say, yeah, this is what's most important to me. Awakening, being awake, but also connecting with others and helping in any way I can their own awakening process. That is more important than my career, than making money, than what particular friends I've got or whatever. It's something that everything else, in a way, is in relationship with. So it involves actually deliberately cultivating mental states, deciding to do that, deciding that's important. Now, this is only one phase of practice, and I think this is something that comes up a lot in meditation teaching. What this phase is what you deliberately do in order to make things different. And, of course, you can overdo that. And you'll get a lot of meditation teachers, quite rightly, saying what we need to be doing is just opening up, just developing acceptance. And sometimes people present Buddhist meditation or Buddhist practice as a whole as simply a process of opening up and just accepting whatever is going on and not trying to make any difference. So you get this very interesting clash, a very interesting, almost like a paradox. Are we trying, you sit down and do a metta bhavana, are you trying to have more metta or are you just opening to what's already there? You know, and they do seem to contradict each other somehow. You know, sometimes you'll find yourself trying too much. It becomes willful, it becomes forced, it becomes tense, and it doesn't actually work. You may even start to sort of berate yourself and say how useless you are and so on. But to say that you should never do that, I think is quite a pernicious mistake. I think both of these phases are needed. Even though they seem to contradict each other, you do need the open acceptance. But you also sometimes need the work. And the way this is traditionally distinguished, or one way it's traditionally distinguished, is the difference between karma and dharma. So we've got two modes of conditionality, in other words, two ways in which you can follow yourself through a sequence of states in order to arrive, say, at more metta. One of them is karma, which karma means action. It means taking action, being engaged with your life, changing things, making things different. Dharma means reality, and so the Dharma process means simply opening to what is real as much as you possibly can. And in a way, the Dharma is a more advanced type of practice than the karma. You may not be able to get very much Dharma going on, very much opening to reality going on, until you've done a certain amount of work on cultivating mental states. And I'm hoping this will come out in our series that we're doing on Tuesdays, keeping the balance between the two. Sometimes just opening to metta as a possibility, opening to it as something that exists in the universe beyond oneself. Nothing to do with me, nothing to do with the agent deliberately doing things. But at other times saying, no, I have to sort of pretend that there is really an agent here, there's really somebody making decisions here, and I have to sort of work with that phase. So I think that's a very interesting area. You have to prepare yourself for open practice. That's the highest kind of practice. Because otherwise your receptivity may just be sitting around, daydreaming, nothing happening at all. So we'll be looking at this in this series, at how you can identify those mental states that you need to make stronger, identifying other ones you need to weaken perhaps, and then working out how to do it, the karma work, the karma niyama work, but also not forgetting the dharma work, which is just opening to reality as it is. So that's very interesting, I think. And that comes out of this sense of going for refuge, making a decision to work. And then following up from going for refuge, the next section is the section of regret and resolution, sometimes in this translation called confession, which is a rather odd thing for us, but of course associated very often with religion. And you do find this in Buddhism as well. So I'm going to read this one out to you, and if you're not familiar with it, I probably find it quite shocking. So the confession is the evil that I've heaped up through my ignorance and foolishness, evil in the world of everyday experience, as well as evil in understanding and intelligence, all that I acknowledge to the protectors. Standing before them, with hands raised in reverence and terrified of suffering, I pay salutations again and again. May the leaders receive this kindly, just as it is, with its many faults. What's not good, O protectors, I shall not do again. So what you have here is the sense that if you've made a definite commitment, if you decided I'm going to go for awakening, you then start to realise the baggage that you've got, the habits that you've got, the regrets that you've got, the problems that you've caused to other people in the past. And you realise that those are hanging on your conscience, they're hanging on your heart in a way. And so you need some way of releasing them. And one of the practices for doing this in traditional Buddhism is the confession practice, if you like, the acknowledgement practice. And you can do it by yourself. You can sit in front of a shrine if you relate to the Buddha and just say, oh, you know, what I said to so-and-so yesterday, I really regret that. That was unskillful. Or even that thing I can remember from 20 years ago that's just been on my conscience for so long. I'd like to drop it. So you're doing these things not to give yourself a hard time. You're doing these things in order to leave them behind. But in order to leave them, maybe you can leave them behind by just ignoring them. But sometimes if you do have a lot of regrets, or if you do have a lot of habits that have caused you problems, then in a way you can't ignore them. And this is why it has this line, terrified of suffering. Because according to Buddhist theory, suffering, most of our suffering is caused by our own unskillfulness, the way we respond to our experience. So if you are in a bicycle accident and break your leg, that is suffering. But if that accident was caused because you were in a furious mood, then that mood is going to make the suffering much worse. So it's said that that mental process of suffering is most of our suffering is mental. Most of it is stuff that goes round and round in our heads. Breaking the leg is nasty, getting ill is nasty, and they obviously are not to do with things going round and round in our heads. They're just physical problems. But they're not, for most people, the main source of suffering. Of course, for some, physical suffering is very great, but for most people, it's mental suffering which is bigger. And it's something which we have some control over. And so he says terrified of suffering, because what he's saying is that a lot of this suffering I can do something about. I can drop the things that I'm doing that are causing my suffering and causing problems to others as well. So I think that's quite an interesting regret and resolution. Being very frank with yourself about which actions and habits are getting in the way of you becoming happier, but also what's getting in the way of you making a positive difference in the world. Even maybe being frank with others about it as well, if you have that kind of trust with them. So it's like maybe being ashamed of things you've done, unhappy with your own habits, and it's not a pleasant state to be in. And so therefore, I think, for some people practicing Buddhism, they would assume it's not a good thing to do. Because it's not nice to feel ashamed, it's not nice to feel regret. But sometimes it does seem that skillful mental states are not necessarily pleasant. And I think it's going to be quite interesting if we go through these different mental states in the series. I'm hoping that some of the speakers will highlight this. What are the states that are maybe even sometimes regarded as to be avoided, but actually they're not so bad. They may be quite good. So shame could be one of them. Maybe it could be skillful to feel shame. painful negative states. Well, here's another thing in the book, Shantideva says in chapter 7. Increase your effort through the following things. Cultivate desire, cultivate pride, savouring pleasure, not making an effort, and control. And he's deliberately chosen here some things that at first sight sound, hang on a minute, you wouldn't want to do those things. Cultivate desire, you know, supposed to be a Buddhist, you don't do that. Cultivate pride, no, surely not, you know. But what he's saying is, no, these can be, and he goes into detail about how you can turn these to the good. rather than just saying, no, I shouldn't have any desire, or I shouldn't have any pride, he says, no, those emotions can be used in a really constructive way. Even the thing of not bothering, not making an effort, this can become the relaxation that you go into in your meditation, and even control, savouring pleasure. And savouring pleasure, yeah, he said, do it, savour pleasure. You can enjoy things, but you can learn a skillful way of doing it. Anyway, so that's quite interesting. Usually qualities that might be seen as quite reprehensible. But Shantideva says, no, maybe there's more to it than that. So I hope we'll get some of that in the series. And then, rejoicing in merit. I rejoice with delight in the good done by all beings, through which they obtain rest with the end of suffering. May those who've suffered be happy. I rejoice in the release of beings from the sufferings of the rounds of existence. I rejoice in the nature of the Bodhisattva and the Buddha, our protectors. I rejoice in the arising of the will to enlightenment and the teaching, those oceans that bring happiness to all beings and are the abode of welfare of all beings. So we're looking at these mental states he's recommending. We've seen the state of esteem. We've seen the state of engagement in karma or going for refuge. We've seen the state of, in a way, shame and regret as being possibly a positive state. Now this one is rejoicing as a positive state. Rejoicing in the good that everybody has done, including yourself. Rejoicing in whenever anybody becomes happy. Just saying that is great. Rejoicing in the release of beings, as he says. Rejoicing in the nature of the Buddha. Rejoicing in the arising of the will to enlightenment, the time when you really get motivated and all that kind of thing. So rejoicing is a good one to cultivate. And the next one is called entreaty and supplication. And this is the state of receptivity. So the state of receptivity to discovering things that you can't necessarily discover for yourself through teachings, through mentors, through being open to new experiences. So he says, saluting them with folded hands, I entreat the Buddhas in all the quarters, may they make shine the lamp of the Dharma for those wandering in the suffering and delusion. With hands folded in reverence, I implore the conquerors desiring to enter Nirvana, may they remain here for endless ages, so that life in this world does not grow dark. So he's talking to the Buddhas, the teachers, mythic ones, real ones, you know, and he's saying, please do let us know what you discovered. Share it. Don't vanish into some Nirvana. No. Nirvana, in a way, is slightly negative in Mahayana because it's regarded as a place where you might be tempted, if you get very deeply into meditation, just to go into a wonderful, serene state and have no communication. And this is saying, no, don't do that. Stay involved. Stay involved in the world. It's really important, even if you get happy yourself, not to sort of neglect the needs of other people. So that's the receptivity. Is the mental state being gone into there. And then we've got two mental states in the last section. The first one is the state of dedication, or sharing your discoveries and sharing the rewards of your practice. So what in this one you do is you say, whatever benefits I get from my practice, I'd like that to benefit everybody, not just me. And then out of that comes what's called the self-surrender. And this is the very highest teaching in the book, I suppose, which is to do with going beyond the self, going beyond self-clinging, and in a way becoming a resource for the whole universe, an aspiration to be a resource, because you've forgotten about the sense of a protected ego, a protected, needy person, and you're just there. And the comparison being made is like the elements. In the same way as the earth doesn't say, oh yeah, you planted a daffodil, I like daffodils, yeah, but no, I'm not going to put up with tulips. So it reject. But the earth will take whatever bulb you put in it. It'll even take rubbish if you put it in it. So in the same way it said, like the earth and the other elements, you become serviceable to all beings. So this is what it says. May the merit gained in my acting thus go to the alleviation of the suffering of all beings. My personality throughout my existences, my possessions, my merit in all three ways, which means past, present, and future, I give up without regard to myself for the benefit of all beings. Just as the earth and the other elements are serviceable in many ways to the infinite number of beings inhabiting limitless space, so may I become that which maintains all beings situated throughout space, so long as all have not attained to peace. So that's, as I say, dedication and going beyond the self.